Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Gretchen McCulloch.
And I'm Lauren Gorn. And in this 30th Patreon bonus episode, we talk about metaphors. But first, Gretchen's book is out by time you're listening to this. Yay!
Yay! If you haven't bought it now, you should buy it. It's very good, if I say so myself, I guess. I keep getting distracted when I was copy-editing my own book by trying to follow the stories in it. So I think that's a good sign.
That is a good sign. And I enjoyed reading it, and I didn't even write it. So that's a stronger recommendation still, I think.
It's a much stronger recommendation. Buying a book in the first week or so that it's out is still really, really helpful. If it has any chance of making any sort of bestseller list, now is the time when it might do so. So if you're thinking, oh, I'll probably buy this eventually, maybe buy it now. We also still have open season for questions about Because Internet for the special behind-the-scenes book bonus episode, which will be coming out next month. And we also still have a special offer for a signed book plate that you can stick into your copy of Because Internet if you join the new Patreon tier about that. So you can check out the links on Patreon, where you already are, to find that.
We also wanted to say another big thank you to you, our patrons. You support this podcast. You help keep it ad-free. You help keep these bonus episodes happening. But we also wanted to thank you for your support on an academic paper that Gretchen and I had come out recently.
Yes, we wrote a paper about the connections between emoji and gesture, which started as a conference paper, and patron support directly paid for my flight to this conference to present it. Laura didn't come because she's in Australia and that's very far away. But she was a joint author.
That would be quite an expensive flight.
But it's fine for just one of us to present it. And it's a norm in academia to acknowledge your funders, which admittedly is often government grants, but we are delighted to acknowledge patrons.
It was really great to be able to write those acknowledgements. They feature you. We'll link to that in the show notes for this episode so you can have a look at the article. Very unsurprising combination of my interest in gesture and Gretchen's interest in emoji, but we're really happy with how it turned out.
Yes, and it's open access if you want to read the whole thing or if academic articles are not quite your cup of tea, which is very fair. You can also read the fun summary version we've made. Lauren, look how far we've come.
I feel like we're at a crossroads.
Are you saying we'll just have to go our separate ways?
I just feel like we can't turn back now.
I don't know if this relationship is going anywhere.
And this year has been a long and bumpy road.
It's really a dead-end street. Okay, so.
How long do you think we can keep that up for?
We are not breaking up the podcast, not breaking up the band. Please don't worry about this. We are merely exploring how you can use an extended metaphor to talk about a relationship as a physical journey.
So a metaphor is when you take features of one thing and you apply them to something else is the most basic way. So here we're talking about a podcasting friendship, but we're using all of these features of a physical journey to talk about that.
Things like going anywhere, long bumpy road, dead end street, crossroads, turning back. Some of these are so ingrained in the way we talk about relationships with people that you don't even necessarily think of them as metaphors anymore. Something like look how far we've come or we'll have to go our separate ways is technically a metaphor. Like going different ways is a physical thing you can do, but it's so ingrained in the way we talk about emotional relationships or friendships or these kinds of things that we don't even necessarily think about them as a metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still going to be here in Melbourne. You're still going to be in Montreal. If we were to, quote unquote, go our separate ways, we would not change anything about our physical location.
In fact, if we were to go in different directions, we would statistically probably end up closer together on this physical Earth orb.
Close together, yeah.
Just saying. Mm-hmm.
But we're so used to thinking in metaphors. And I think this idea of extended metaphors, it's not. I think when I learned about metaphors in high school, it was like you do one clever thing in one sentence with some words. But actually, the thing I love about metaphors is that they are kind of pervasive in the way that we think.
Yeah, like I remember learning kind of like my love is a red, red rose or something like this and think, okay, well, you know, that's fine. I guess this poet's going to do this. But the kind that are really fascinating are the ones that we use every day without even thinking about them as much. Do we want to do a bit of etymology?
Yeah, I think so.
So metaphor comes, you know, via French, via Latin, from the Greek metaphora, meaning transfer, from meta, which means over, and phero, which means to bear or to carry. So the meta also shows up in other prefix like metaphysics, which is like over physics, or sometimes you talk about something being very meta, it's beyond the literal sense. And fair, meaning carry, shows up in...
Oh, like transfer.
Well, that's the Latinate equivalent. Fair shows up in other words like paraphernalia, which are like the extra things you carry around with you, or semaphore.
Semaphore like the flags?
Yeah, like the flags, which I guess are like probably signs that you carry.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it's less directly related to fer in Latin, as in transfer itself. So a metaphor carries something over... carries an idea over from one domain to another, and often from a concrete domain to a more abstract domain.
This goes back to one of our favorite themes on the show, which is the idea that humans are just giant meat puppets, and language is always kind of tied to the very physicalness of our human bodies.
Yeah, and so even when we're talking about really abstract ideas, it's easier to do so if we invoke very physical things in the world.
And you find that a lot of the metaphors have a consistent... especially, like, even if you look cross-culturally, there's some variation, we'll talk about that. But overall, there's these common features where if something is good, it's upwards, and bad is downwards. Happy is upwards, and sad is downwards. There's this kind of correlation between this, and it has to do with the fact that we are bipedal and vertical beings.
And we have to kind of struggle against gravity. So if you manage to succeed against gravity and stand up, that's probably good. If you're lying flat on the ground, maybe you're dead or something.
Yeah.
And another one that I really like is phrases like to grasp a concept or to gather what you've understood. And that uses a physical action of picking up or holding something as a metaphor for understanding something.
So again, like, ideas are very vague and abstract. And so we turn ideas into physical concepts, like little physical blocks. I could give you this idea. Or we could put all ideas together.
Yeah, or sometimes we use sight to talk about ideas. I see what you mean. That sounds clear to me. Those are using a different metaphor to talk about a similar domain because ideas are very abstract. I had a really fun experience a few months ago when I learned that the German word wichtig, which I'd always kind of had trouble remembering, it means important. And, you know, that's fine. Like, they clearly didn't borrow it from Latin and French like English did. But I always was like, okay, wichtig, that sounds like it should have some sort of word that's related to it in English, but the word that I think of it being related to in English is definitely not anything sounding like important. And then I learned that it could also be translated as heavy, which is also gewichtig, which thereby makes it cognate with weighty.
Ooh, a weighty idea. Yeah.
A weighty idea is an important idea, right?
That sits really well with me.
Yeah, exactly. And even if I wouldn't necessarily talk about a weighty idea myself, I can use that as a memory peg for, oh, wichtig, something's a weighty idea, it's important. Or a person is wichtig, they're weighty, they're important, they've got dignitas and gravitas they're bringing into the room.
We are absolutely by no means the first people to observe these features of metaphors as being very grounded in our experience and kind of extended across lots of little examples mapping onto this one big idea. This is something that's come out of a field called cognitive semantics. George Lakoff is one of the key practitioners. You may have heard of him. He likes to do public commentary on kind of big cultural metaphors a lot. But lots of people have been working on this over the years, kind of documenting or looking at these pervasive metaphors, looking at how they vary across cultures. One of my absolutely favorite things about this area is a study by Gettner and Gettner from 1982 that shows how not only do these metaphors kind of exist in our brain, but they can affect the way we think about and process information in the world. So they had a study where they were teaching people how electric circuits work.
Okay.
And they had two different metaphors. So the first is moving people through a series of passages. So in this case, the
So like tunnels, like you might send people down to the subway in or something like that.
Yeah. So that was your wires, are your courses or passages. And then your...
Electrons?
Electrons are little people.
Okay.
And then the current is... how many people kind of can go through the passage. Voltage is how many people are pushing. So you map those things. So they taught a whole bunch of people that metaphor for how an electric circuit works.
Okay.
And then they taught a different group of people a metaphor for electric circuits on a hydraulic, like, water pumping system.
Hmm. So now your pipes are your wires.
Yep.
And the water is, like, your electrons or something.
Yep. And then the flow rate of the water is the current, as opposed to the flow rate of people.
Right. Okay.
So once they taught them these metaphors, and, like, you know, you kind of figured them out as soon as I said them. They have obvious mappings between the original domain and these areas that they were using as metaphors. Once they taught people the metaphors, they got them to think about electrical systems using the metaphors. So things like serial versus parallel battery configurations, which is definitely a thing I remember learning about in high school physics. Don't really remember the science behind.
I don't think I did. If I did, I don't remember it, but I don't even know if I ever learned it.
And they found that because the way batteries are cabled up, if you have them, like, all lined up together, or you have them all coming off different cables and coming back, it affects how things like voltage and resistance work. And the flowing water metaphor was actually a better predictor. If people learnt the flowing water metaphor, they could figure out the better outcome of how that works. Having the water pumped through different pumps was a better analogy for batteries. But if you were looking at serial versus parallel resistor configurations, and who amongst us has not?
Me, actually.
The crowded passages of people actually gave you a better metaphor for correctly predicting what would happen in that circumstance.
Oh, that's interesting. So different metaphors can help you reason about different domains.
Yeah, but a metaphor can only take you so far, right? So even though both of them are pretty good metaphors and, like, you could figure them out even without knowing a whole lot about how electrical systems worked.
And definitely not know anything about resistors or batteries.
That's still, the metaphor can only go so far.
Yeah, right. That makes sense. And I mean, we do this sometimes when we're coming up with episode topics. We'll say, okay, we're going to need a metaphor to talk about verbs. You know, what are some physical objects that have similar properties to the things that we want to talk about with respect to verbs or with respect to sounds or various other types of pieces in language, which can be fairly abstract, to say, let's give people a very concrete object that they can touch or they can visualize and have some sense of how it works.
We spent ages with the coat rack one, which was explaining how verbs kind of help structure sentences. And we kept stress testing the metaphor.
Yeah, I remember that one because we recorded that episode when I was visiting you in Australia. And I remember we went for a walk, you know, the day before we recorded it, saying we need a metaphor. Let's talk through a bunch of different possibilities. Like, what are some things that have multiple relationships with each other? And I ended up being very pleased with the coat rack metaphor in that episode. But it took us kind of walking through a bunch of different other metaphors. I know we rejected, like, the verb is like the skeleton and the other parts of the sentence are like body parts that can hang on to that because one of the big problems.
You can rearrange coat racks much easier than you can rearrange human skeletons.
Yeah, we really didn't want to go super gruesome. Even though sometimes a skeleton is used as a metaphor, like this is the backbone of the industry or the skeleton key can open different things, something like that. But so skeleton is sometimes used as a metaphor in a non-gruesome sense, but in this particular context, we want to talk about things going on and off. It was just going to end up really bloody.
And the thing I found fascinating is we recorded that whole episode and we actually had different physical coat racks in our minds.
Yeah, because you had the coat rack in your mind that's like kind that you like hang against the wall?
No, I had the freestanding coat rack.
You had the freestanding one. Maybe I had the one hanging against the wall. I kind of had both, maybe.
Turns out Gretchen's idea of a coat rack is much more fast and loose than mine. I have a very specific physical model in my head when I was building the metaphor.
Well, I think, because I think I call a coat rack, like, it has to be hitting against the wall versus the other kind I call, like, a hull tree or a coat tree.
That's a cute metaphor.
Yeah, it's also a metaphor. Look at that. But it doesn't really matter because, in the end, the thing that was relevant of, like, how many hooks do you have and these kinds of things was sufficiently parallel for the particular thing that we were talking about. There are actually people whose professional job it is to design metaphors.
That's a pretty fun job.
Yeah, it always seems like a very cool job to me. One of them is Michael Erard, who works for the Frameworks Institute as a professional metaphor designer. I think that was an institution that Lakoff founded, right?
Yeah, he's definitely involved in some way. I think he founded it.
One of the examples of a metaphor that they designed at Frameworks was looking at children's executive function. So kind of like how your brain is organized and how much you control how to do things as if it's air traffic control for your brain.
So
air traffic controller, obviously those people who are like telling the airplanes when they can come down. And the insight that they had from this was, yes, it's important for organization. Yes, it's important to be organized, and training and runway space is also important, but ultimately there can also only be so many planes in the air.
Right.
Or you just overload your brain's air traffic controllers. So if you're wondering why children are, you know, frustrated and unable to do all the things they want to do, maybe they can just only keep so many planes in the air. And you can support that to a certain extent by improving their organizational skills, but you can't expect people to keep more planes in the air than they're capable of doing.
Yeah. So in order to kind of sell this metaphor, they had to do what we do for the episodes and kind of test them and make sure that all the implications of the metaphor aren't potentially problematic.
Yeah. And there was another metaphor that I remember reading Michael Arad criticizing, which was there was some sort of metaphor about dandelion children versus orchid children.
Oh, dear.
And the problem with this metaphor is that, okay, these are two different flowers. People know what these flowers are. Like, you know, they certain give you...
I'm trying really hard to sit here and be like, dandelion children are yellow? No, because you get yellow orchids. Do you get yellow orchids?
So dandelion children, supposedly, according to this metaphor, can kind of bloom wherever they're planted, whereas orchid children require more delicate care and feeding.
Right.
Or delicate emotional attention.
Oh, I was thinking of irises.
In theory, this is a useful distinction. But the problem is that people have very different values associated with dandelions versus orchids.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone's like, oh, great, I want my kid to be an orchid kid. And that was actually what they were trying to call attention to as, like, it's dangerous for your kid to be an orchid kid. How can we create more dandelions? Because dandelions thrive everywhere.
In my brain, it's like weed children versus ugly children.
Yeah, so... I mean, some people like orchids, Lauren. And the problem was, is most people, on average, like orchids more than they like dandelions. And so it even though the metaphor kind of works from a characteristic property sense, I guess, it also comes with a value judgment that, like, ultimately made it not a very good metaphor for trying to help people improve their parenting practices.
Was also ignoring a lot of other characteristics.
Yeah, like, make your child more like a dandelion and less like an orchid is a really hard sell to parents.
Every time I think of orchids, I think of people using, like, little spray bottles. So now I'm thinking of people, like, spray bottling their children.
It's just, you know, like, they're very finicky. They grow in these, like, you know, greenhouses and stuff like that, whereas dandelions will just grow in the cracks in the sidewalk. So it's, you can see why maybe you want your kid to be able to bloom wherever they're planted. Like, that sounds like a good idea. And yet orchids are just so rare and valuable that this also seems like a really good idea. But one better metaphor that I actually heard Michael Arad talk about at the Polyglot Conference in New York City a number of years ago was that he came up with a new metaphor for language learning. And he said that it's developing a complex skill like weaving a rope.
Hmm.
And so in this metaphor, a good rope has many strands, which have to be woven together tightly in order for the rope to be strong.
Yeah.
And so the strands and the techniques of weaving the rope are kind of like the skills that you learn, that you begin with, and that you learn and you develop as you're doing it. But the rope won't weave itself. And so it's not just like you learn the language and it's done, it's that you're building up all of these different strands and putting them together. And, you know, that you have a lot of time and effort going into putting it together. And then once it's complete, the rope is a usable thing, a tool. You can do something with language when you've learned it. But some people think of learning a language as like, I don't know, filling a bucket or something, like you pour it in the language and there it is and you never have to do anything else.
Yeah.
And so this idea of emphasizing the process and all of the different steps of learning a language could be useful to people thinking about their own language learning more productively.
Nice. I like that metaphor.
Yeah, it's quite nice. Because I think, you know, as linguists, you often face the kind of like, how many languages do you know question. And the no implies that there's an endpoint. And if you talk about weaving a rope, it's very clear that there isn't one logical size of rope that, like, then you have the rope, that a rope can be potentially infinitely long in theory.
Yeah. It's like, I now just have like a few strings of Polish.
Exactly. Yeah, you can conceive of having different amounts of, or like I have some like raggedy old, whatever language that I've forgotten, or I've just acquired the shiny new string of another language.
We've talked a lot so far about metaphors kind of being shared in a particular group of people, and like, you know, when you have the cultural references, dandelion children versus orchid children make sense, but, you know, even as someone who is ostensibly from the culture that metaphor was designed for, I failed. And when you look across cultures, you do get culturally grounded knowledge that's required to understand metaphors. And I teach this with a metaphor from the Songhai language in Mali. I want you to kind of see what you can make of this metaphor, Gretchen.
Okay.
The words of the elders are like the droppings of the hyena.
Okay, so I've definitely never seen hyena droppings.
Mm-hmm.
But words of the elders are probably good, right? So that must mean that this culture thinks the droppings of the hyena are also good, which means that I'm reasoning from the abstract to the concrete domain rather than the other way around, which is presumably what this metaphor actually wants me to be doing.
You're back-logicking.
I guess maybe if I'm thinking of like the droppings of like a bear or a deer or something, which is an animal that I'm more familiar with, you could use those to tell where they're going and maybe be better at hunting them. So it gives you information and clues and stuff. So maybe that's also what they think about the hyena droppings.
I mean, I guess the first thing is that like equating anything with poo is generally seen as negative in our culture.
Right.
So
I was trying to be positive because presumably they're not like, oh, those elders, they're talking such bull, you know.
Bull poo.
BS.
The culturally relevant knowledge that you need here, or the like locally relevant knowledge that you don't have, is that hyena droppings are like opaque and cloudy when they're first done, and then they kind of become see-through and transparent. I don't know how this works, but
interesting.
This is apparently a fact.
This is not a chemistry podcast.
And so the words of the elders are initially unclear and opaque, but like a good prophecy, they become clearer, or their wisdom becomes clearer over time.
Oh, that's really good. That's really elegant.
Yeah, it is a really elegant metaphor, but only if you know how hyena droppings work.
Yeah, which clearly I didn't know, so I was just trying to base that on other droppings of other animals, which don't have this very specific translucifying property.
And I think metaphors are always one of those... There are sentences when I've learnt languages where it's like, I understand each one of these words. I don't really know what this sentence means.
Yeah.
Because metaphors are definitely some of those more elaborate rope weaving parts of the language learning process, to borrow Michael Arad's metaphor.
Yeah, and understanding the literal words doesn't necessarily mean you have the cultural context. Sometimes it's a cultural reference, like if you're making some sort of, like, oh, this is from a game show 30 years ago that everyone used to watch and we still make this reference, but actually, you know, if you haven't seen this game show, you don't know that's where it's coming from or something like that.
I think also we've talked a lot about, you know, that metaphors are kind of persistent and they have these big extended uses. But just because we have a kind of cognitive image of how things map from one domain to the other doesn't mean that we don't mess them up.
And people do mess them up. This is known sometimes as a malaphor, which is like a metaphor, but gone bad. Specifically named after, I think, the Dickensian character Mrs. Malaprop, who used to get words mixed up, but also just mal in general is bad. And so you get things like, I wouldn't trust him with a 10-foot pole.
Oh no, that's combining, I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him?
Yes.
And I wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole?
Yes, and then you end up with, I wouldn't trust him with a 10-foot pole. Which, like, you could say, but is not an existing metaphor in our culture.
But it's actually quite satisfying, because it combines both of them.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got a list of some of these malaphors.
Excellent.
If you, Lauren, would like to try to identify what the original metaphors are, or we can go back and forth if you want, because maybe...
Yeah, let's do that. And if you're playing along at home, you can get your phone or your computer out and hit the pause button and argue away with people that you're listening with.
Yeah, see if you can guess before us. Okay, do you want to go first then?
Sure. Don't judge a book before it's hatched.
Ah, this is definitely true about my book. Okay. So I think that's combining don't judge a book by its cover and don't count your chickens before they're hatched. What about every cloud has a silver spoon in its mouth?
Oh, this is riffing on silver for both of them, I think, because it's...
Yeah!
Every cloud has a silver lining, which means that, like, even bad things can have good bits to them. And if someone's born with a silver spoon in their mouth, which I used to imagine literally, the problem with metaphors, but it just means that they are super fancy.
You mean your baby was not born with a silver spoon in its
thankfully
mouth?
Thankfully.
Literally?
Thankfully.
Yes, I think that's what those are.
It's not rocket surgery.
I think that's pretty easy, right? So it's not rocket science and it's not brain surgery. I guess you could also have it's not brain science.
doesn't quite
as catchy.
Doesn't quite capture it, does it?
You can't teach a leopard new spots.
Oh, you can't teach a... I see this one. You can't teach an old dog new tricks, but you can't change a leopard's spots.
Yeah.
That one's like a really elaborate mashup.
That one's pretty elaborate.
The train has left the frying pan.
So the train has left the station, and I guess the frying pan out of the frying pan into the fire or something?
Yeah, so the train is on its way to the fire, I guess, is the visual image we've got going here.
Yeah. Until the cows come home to roost.
Until the cows come home? Is that a thing? Until the... And your chickens come home to roost.
Yeah, I think until the cows come home is like, we'll be talking about this until the cows come home, like, forever.
Yeah.
And then the chickens come home to roost is another farm metaphor.
I guess we should say that metaphors also just encompass, like, general aphorisms and sayings, which may not actually be metaphors in the way we always think about them, but they're kind of all grouped in together like this.
And because they're so fun to look at.
And because they're so fun, we're just going to share a few more. Until the pigs freeze over.
Oh, this is good. So this is until pigs fly with until hell freezes over. I guess you could also do until hell flies, but I don't know if that works as well. It'll be a walk in the cake.
See, this combines it'll be a walk in the park with it'll be a cakewalk. And a cakewalk is a thing I do not know what it is, but I know that it means that it will be easy.
So when I was in school, they used to do cakewalks sometimes as like charity fundraisers.
What was that?
They weren't especially easy, and I don't know if this is the only kind of cakewalk there is. But they were kind of like musical chairs, but like the last person left would win a cake, basically.
Oh. Combines a thing I hate, musical chairs, with a thing I love, winning cakes. But it also shows how idioms and metaphors can contain, like, fossilized knowledge that we now no longer have.
Yeah, exactly.
A cakewalk is now more common in a saying than an actual event in my life, although not in yours, apparently.
And then we also get, in addition to kind of the very tightly mixed up metaphors, you get longer mixed metaphors, which is when you end up with two metaphors referring to the same thing. So ideas can be both things you grasp and also things you see, but mixing them in a way that seems sort of weird. So something like, if we can hit that bullseye, then the rest of the dominoes will fall like a house of cards. Checkmate. You've got a whole bunch of different game metaphors all stacked up on top of each other that each of them would work individually, but together they end up with a really confusing set of imagery.
Should say that was Futurama character Zaf Brannigan, known for being a bit of a dolt. So that was like, that was a very deliberately constructed mixed metaphor.
Yes, that's true. I mean, this tends to happen with maybe only two examples in a more realistic sense.
But I guess it shows how the brain can kind of operate with different metaphors happening at the same time.
Can we end this episode with my very favorite metaphor pun?
Yes, please.
Metaphors be with you. For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I can be found as @GretchenAMcSee on Twitter, and my blog is allthingslinguistic.com. And my book is Because Internet. You should buy it.
I tweet and blog as Superlinguo. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gorn. Our audio producer is Claire Gorn, our managing editor is Emily Greff, and our production editor is Sarah Doppiarella. Our music is Ancient Cities by The Triangles. Thanks to Margaret Gardner for suggesting this topic.
Thanks so much for being a patron.
And stay Lingthusiastic.